Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
What does a legitimate abduction look like? We're going to talk about that and compare and contrast as to what we know, what's been happening here in this horrific Nancy Guthrie situation. Your thoughts in the comments section, weigh in right now. Give them to me on Substack or on our YouTube. The links are in the descriptions. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're at right now, so you don't miss any of this. Here's the thing that keeps showing up in cases like this. In virtually every abduction that's ever been studied, FBI data, behavioral analysis units, decades of post-incident research, investigators find the same thing when they rewind the clock. The predator was watching before they ever moved. Not minutes before, days, sometimes weeks. And in almost every single case, somebody in the victim's orbit saw something that didn't feel right. They noticed something out of place, so they did nothing about it because they didn't know what they were looking at. That's the gap. That is the space where these crimes live and breathe, the space between. Not in the moment someone gets taken, but in the days and weeks before when the groundwork is being laid in plain sight, just nobody knows what they're looking at, except for one person. And if you want a real-time illustration of how that looks and what it looks like, look at what happened to Nancy Guthrie, the 84-year-old woman living alone in a rural community outside Tucson, Arizona. On the night of January 31st, her family drops her off after dinner. Garage door opens at 9:48, closes 2 minutes later. That's the last confirmed moment anyone she loved saw her, allegedly. Then at 1:47 in the morning, her doorbell camera disconnects, not malfunctions, disconnects. 25 minutes later at 2:12, a second camera software detects a person on the property, but there's no video. Why? Because no one had an active subscription to save the footage. 16 minutes after that, her pacemaker app shows its lost connection to her phone. By morning, Nancy Guthrie is gone. Her phone is still in the house. Her medications are still in the house. She is not. And here's what hits you when you sit with those details. That level of precision doesn't come from impulse. Whoever moved on that house that night knew what they were walking into. They knew about the cameras. They knew how to neutralize them. They knew when she'd be alone. That kind of operational awareness doesn't materialize out of thin air. It gets built. It gets gathered. Even though it does seem somewhat simplistic, you do have to kind of know, do they have a camera here? Do they have a camera there? And it appears they did, whoever they are. That information gathering, it's important. Because every abduction, whether it's a kidnapping or a ransom, a targeted home invasion or a stranger grab off the street, it follows a cycle. Security professionals call it the attack cycle. The FBI's behavioral analysis unit has studied it across hundreds of cases, and the stages are consistent: target selection, surveillance planning, and then deployment. The deployment, the actual taking, is almost always the shortest phase. It's the fast, it's violent, and by the time it's happening, it's essentially already over. The surveillance phase is where the real crime takes shape. It's where the predator is most exposed, most vulnerable to being caught, and where the people around the target have the most power to change the outcome. But most people don't know that. Most people are focused on the dramatic moment, the broken door, the missing person, the 911 call. The real story is everything that happened before any of that. And the research backs this up in ways that you should be aware of. Studies of criminal planning patterns have found that roughly 90% of victims in documented abduction cases recalled noticing something suspicious before the crime happened. 90%. They saw the car that didn't belong. They noticed the person who lingered a little too long. They had that feeling in the back of their neck, and they let it go. I mean, look at the Koberger case. Lots of reports of weird behavior, strange behavior, bizarre activity from somebody nobody knew at the time. And it turns out it was probably Brian Koberger. But maybe that's what makes it so difficult these days, is the amount of information that our brains are trying to process, the amount that's coming at us at any given time. We are so overloaded. We are so overwhelmed. We're not equipped to be able to decipher it to a level that maybe we would have, in a different place in time, been a little better at. And here's what I'm saying about that, is we get so much coming at us from every which direction, whether it be online, social, real life, the people. I mean, there's a lot of places. And years ago, we didn't have as much noise coming at us from all directions at all times. But that just kind of seems to be how we're living these days. So the ability to notice when something is off, when something is a little weird, it's a lot easier to dismiss. Not because we want to, not because we're being careless or foolish, but because it's more noise in a world that's already filled with so much of it. And we're not, our brains are not equipped to be able to be that accurate at picking out every single little thing that might be off. And these predators know that, because when they are studying this, when they're figuring out what they're going to do, who they're going to go after, they know they're going to blend in with the noise. That's their goal. And they know to do it well. So let's talk about what predators are actually looking for when they're in the target selection phase, because it's not random. It's calculation, a cold, deliberate risk-benefit analysis, and understanding that is the first step towards actually disrupting it. First, they're looking for isolation. People who live alone in setback properties without neighbors, who have a clear line of sight, long driveways, properties bordered by open desert or wooded areas or golf courses. The irony is brutal. The very features that make a home feel peaceful and private are the same features that make it attractive to someone casing it for a crime. Dense landscaping that blocks a view from the street, no foot traffic, limited ambient lighting, a house where someone could approach at 2 a.m. and not a single soul would see them. Second, they're looking for predictability, fixed routine, same dinner every Saturday night, same church every Sunday morning, same lights off at the same time. Kidnappers and abduction planners build what professionals call a pattern of life on their targets. And the more rigid that pattern is, the wider the operational window becomes. If a predator knows exactly where you'll be and exactly when your home will be empty, they don't need to be sophisticated. They just need to be patient. Third, they're assessing perceived vulnerability. Research going back decades, studies done with incarcerated offenders, FBI victimology reports, behavioral analysis consistently shows that predators assess their targets physically. Gait, body type, apparent fitness level, awareness. An elderly person living independently, particularly one with visible physical limitation, signals both potential value and low resistance. That's not a comfortable thing to say, but it is what the data shows. And fourth, and this is the one that connects directly to what happened in Tucson, they're cataloging security gaps. Cameras that exist but aren't recording. Doorbell systems that can be physically removed from a wall, alarm systems that aren't monitored, smart home devices running outdated firmware, the appearance of security without the substance of it. And this is where it gets deeply unsettling, because Nancy Guthrie had cameras. She had that doorbell camera. But the one system that might have captured the person on her property, it wasn't saving footage because no one was paying for the cloud storage subscription. The security infrastructure, it looked present. Functionally, at the moment it mattered most, it wasn't. Why? Because this sort of thing just doesn't seem to happen around there. Doesn't really happen anywhere, to be completely honest. Kidnappings are not a common thing at the end of the day. And you're like, well, it must happen all the time. No, it really doesn't. It really doesn't. There's not a lot of kidnappings like this for ransom in a scenario of this, especially with elderly people. It's like less than 100 a year. So, well, got to be prepared. Yeah, I mean, you can. You sure? You should, I guess. But I can also understand why she wasn't. 84 years old, got along this good, this far, this peaceful of a life, lived there for a long time, knew her neighbors, knew her community. There wasn't a big uptick in crime or problems or anything that would make one go, huh, better make sure that we got this going on. Where your Ring doorbell cameras are used more so to catch wildlife playing in your yard than predators. That's the reality. I know far more people who send me pictures of squirrels or the neighbor's cat or a dog or a coyote or insert animal here, insert non-threatening animal here that gets caught on the Ring cameras or the Nest cameras than actual crimes or predators. And hey, that's a good thing. That's a good thing that that's a majority of what's being caught. But the reality is it's not the only thing. Let's talk about what the surveillance phase actually looks like in practice, because this is where the public's understanding completely falls apart. When most people think of something being watched, they picture a figure in a dark car with binoculars. That's Hollywood. In reality, hostile surveillance looks ordinary. It looks like the delivery driver who shows up one too many times, the jogger who runs at the same route past your house at slightly different hours, the person parked at the end of the street looking at their phone a little too intently. It blends. That's the entire point. The U.S. government teaches a surveillance detection framework called TED. Time, environment, distance, and demeanor. The principle is straightforward. If you see the same person or vehicle at different times, in different environments, across varying distances from you, it's not coincidence. It's surveillance. The fourth element, demeanor, is the easiest to spot if you're looking, because here's the part that should both terrify and empower you. Most criminals are terrible at surveillance. They linger too long. They overdress or underdress for the environment. They check behind themselves too frequently. They make eye contact and then they look away too fast. The mistakes are there. The tells are there. The problem has never been that predators are invisible. The problem is we've collectively trained ourselves not to look. And that brings us to what might be the most uncomfortable piece of all of this. And it's a principle that applies to every targeted abduction that's ever been profiled. The insider question. In kidnapping for ransom cases specifically, security consultancies and FBI case reviews have documented a consistent pattern. Abductors frequently attempt to recruit or leverage someone who already has access to the target. Household staff, service workers, contractors, landscapers, anyone who's been inside the house and can answer the question that external surveillance alone cannot. What's the alarm code? What cameras are actually functional? Which doors lock and which ones stick? When does she go to bed? When is she completely alone? In the Guthrie investigation, Sheriff Nanos confirmed that Nancy had house staff and that some of them had been in contact with law enforcement. That's what Nanos said. And as we know, Nanos has been super reliable and accurate. Oh, wait, he's not at all. But let's say what he's saying is true. Because it is standard procedure. Investigators in every targeted abduction case look inward before they look outward. Because the most dangerous form of surveillance isn't the stranger parked on the street. It's the person who was already invited through the front door. This isn't speculation about who did what in this case. It's not. We're just talking generalities here. Nobody has been named as a suspect as of now, but the principle is ironclad and it holds across the full universe of these crimes. When an abduction shows this level of planning, when the perpetrator knew the security layout, knew the routine, knew the vulnerabilities, the first investigative question is always the same. How did they know? And think about what we know from the timeline law enforcement released. The doorbell camera didn't glitch out. It was disconnected physically at 1:47 in the morning. It's not software hiccups. It's consistent with someone who understood what that device was and what it could capture. That tells investigators, and it should tell all of us, that whatever happened to Nancy Guthrie was not impulsive. Somebody did their homework. Or did they? Or did they see it and go, oh, shit, gotta take this? I don't know. It's not an impossibility. But also, an impossibility is someone literally sitting at home going, you know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm going to go abduct Nancy Guthrie. Why not? It's 1:30 in the morning. I just finished watching reruns of Happy Days. Let's go take Nancy Guthrie. I mean, that's somebody planned this. Or something happened. And somebody didn't want to be caught. So where does that leave us? Not just with this case, but with the broader reality of how these crimes work and what we can actually do about them. The attack cycle exists in every predatory crime. And the single most powerful point of intervention is the surveillance phase, because that's the window where the predator is exposed and where basic awareness can change the outcome. You don't need to be a former FBI agent to recognize when something is off. You just need to be present. You need to notice the car that doesn't belong on your street. You need to register the person who's looking at your house instead of walking past it. You need to recognize when your routines have become so fixed and so visible that a stranger with bad intentions could set a clock by them. It's not victim blaming. This is just general awareness. This is not, in no way, I'm not even talking about Nancy Guthrie. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about being more aware of our settings. And for families with elderly relatives living independently, this part is for you specifically. The vulnerability profile is real, and it's compounding. Isolation, predictability, security systems that exist in name only. A camera that's not recording is not security. It's a prop. An alarm that's not monitored is not a deterrent. It's decoration. And a routine so rigid that it broadcasts your loved one's whereabouts to anyone paying attention is not stability. It is a roadmap. None of this is about fear. It's about awareness. It's about understanding that the crime doesn't begin when the door opens at 2 in the morning. It begins days or weeks earlier when someone starts watching and nobody watches back. The predator's greatest advantage has never been strength. It's never been speed or weapons or some mastermind-level brilliance. In case after case, the advantage is simpler and more devastating than any of that. It's the fact that most people just aren't paying attention. And every predator who's ever moved on a target is counting on exactly that. We, of course, want nothing but a positive outcome here in this case. And let's hope that we still get it. You may be watching this after the outcome has been revealed, or I don't even know what to say. I mean, it's been revealed. Seems like we've come to a conclusion. You may be watching it then. None of what I said goes away just because we reached that conclusion. Everything we talked about in this video is applicable for anyone out there. At any point in time, no matter how this story ends, we need to be more aware of our surroundings. Because we're living in a world that is relying on us being distracted more and more every day, and we are willingly becoming distracted. And I think in a lot of ways, not even aware of that fact. Or the cause and effect of that fact. That while we have so many more distractions, we're all going, I wish I could be more present. I wish I could, you know what I'm talking about? That feeling of like, I wish I was more there. Well, there's more to it than just feeling better about yourself or feeling like you're being more engaged and present with the people you're caring about. Your safety is also at play as well. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube or Substack. The links are in the description. Hiddenkillers.substack.com. Come join us there. There's no paywall. You can interact and comment on any of our cases and, in fact, get our reporting a day before everybody else gets it. So go check it out now, hiddenkillers.substack.com. And if you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, do check out those. If you're not, if you're watching us, go press subscribe on the podcast so you take us in audio form with you wherever you go. You can listen to us in the car, on your walks, in your workout, at the gym, whatever it may be. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get podcasts. That's where you'll find us. All right. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll continue our conversation in the comments, and we'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The physical evidence at Nancy Guthrie's home has been the subject of intense scrutiny, not just for what investigators have found, but for what they've missed and how the scene was handled initially. The crime scene was released back to the family just one day after Nancy was reported missing, then re-entered four separate times over the following week. A rooftop camera overlooked for 5 days. Chain of custody questions are already being raised by legal analysts. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us to help us break down our conversation about the crime scene that we've been looking at. On a Sunday afternoon, they got into what appears to be a septic system. At least that's what the conjecture has been from everybody that's seen the video of them opening a hole in the ground. This is an area that we do know does not have like a public sewer system. Every home and neighbors have said, yes, we all have our own septic tanks. So that's likely what the hole in the ground and the pit that they were, you know, scraping around in is. Let's just start there. Supposedly, you know, we have no suspects. We don't have any vehicles of interest. These are the things that are being publicly said. And there's supposedly these ramps and notes and they're willing to pay, yet they're digging into the septic tank. What's going on?
As they're getting more data and they're getting more likely, they're getting more people in with the experience of doing these sorts of things. They're having to go back in and do things that weren't done before or redo things that weren't done at the level they wanted them done. Septic system, fantastic. I'm glad they're not on a city sewer, because if there was something that was disposed of through a bathroom in some way, secreted down a drain, they're going to take all the drain stops out, as well as the septic. They can examine that as well for whoever was inside the house using those things. And if it was an inside type of job of a worker or something, stuff might have been there, you know, for last week too. So, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. So I'm glad that we're seeing them do those sorts of things, grabbing things off of roofs. Now, the sequence of it, giving things back, there's some chaos, I think, at the leadership level of this, as we're seeing. But the fact that they're still doing a lot says a lot of good things to me. I'm glad they are. And I don't think that the main scene is really at Nancy's house. I think Annie's house is going to have a lot more at it, just because, again, it really depends on the caretaker side of an aspect of this.
And I want to talk about that, because there's been some reporting on this from reporters that I know and that I trust and that we know and that are good, that are not just going to throw random things out there. Ashley Banfield's not going to Reddit and running with just random shit that she finds. And some of the early reporting that was done on this that she's gotten a lot of flack for talks about possibly the son-in-law being looked at as a prime suspect. Now, there's been no official official word of that whatsoever. That was from her reporting from a trusted source, according to her, somewhere within the ether of this ecosystem. I want to talk about that, not from an angle of, is this the guy or anything like that, but how that reporting can be accurate and he may not be our person by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. Whereas at that moment in time, early in the investigation, whatever day that was, like day two or three or something, that reporting came out, the investigation may have been looking at him as a prime suspect. They're going to look at family first. They're going to look at the people closest to her first. So at that moment in time, that sentence, that headline may be accurate. As investigations continue to progress, you rule people out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. We don't. Nobody knows at this time if he's ever even been a suspect whatsoever, or if he's been ruled out, or if he's even part of the conversation of such things. But both can parallelly be true, where at a moment it is true, but it's not the person at the end of the day. That's why it's not always the best idea to run and publish that information until you actually know who truly is a long-term suspect, not just who's the flavor of the day at that moment in time. Let's talk about the optics here, because a lot of people are still looking at this going, oh my gosh, but look at all the activity at Annie's house and her husband's house. Look at, they were in there, they were taking pictures over the weekend, they were going in and out. There was, from people are speculating that there was a Cellbrite computer that went in to scan the information off the cell phones and all that. And okay, that can be true. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they had anything to do with the disappearance. You have some interesting thoughts on that as an investigator. Give me your take on that.
Yeah, I thought long and hard about this, Tony, and I like that they're at Nancy's house doing a lot, because as I took a step back and said, all right, what would cause someone to do that? What would make investigators do that? And so let's look at this. So here's Nancy, elderly woman, and Annie's been her caretaker as reported and seen for quite a while now.
Yeah.
As caretaker, they would be the ones that were most likely setting up maintenance on the house, medical appointments, you know, lawn mowing, plumbing work, roof work, you name it, it was going through Annie. And so when she's setting things up, whose records is it going to be in? Is it going to be in Nancy's or in Annie's? Mm-hmm. It's going to be in Annie's. And so if I was going to do a digital deep dive, am I going to do it on the elderly lady who is just being told by her daughter what's coming and when is it going to happen? Or am I going to do it on the daughter's house and all the electronics inside that house? Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they're doing a deep electronic dive inside of Annie's house with all electronics and bringing in equipment and everything, good. That means the fact that they're still there means they're getting a lot. They're getting, because there's years and years and years of data. And so what they're doing is they're collecting all this data, all the contacts, all the contractors, absolutely everything. And now they got to follow those leads on all those people, all those timelines, everything, right? And here's the other thing. Every single case that I've ever covered where someone inside a tight circle might be a suspect for a period of time that might have something to hide, you know what they do? They lawyer up and say, no more access. Not the case here. And then you go even a deeper level on this. Yes, the family is always the first. Elizabeth Smart's father said this on Fox the other day and other channels that, you know, they have to rule out the family first because the law of averages say that's most likely who it's going to be involved in, because these things are so rarely random. It's, and you start in these concentric circles, family, associates, and out and out and out and out. And so you start at the family first to rule them out. And so you are going to look at everyone first, you know, so Ashley Bansfield's sources were most likely accurate that they was a suspect, like everyone was a suspect in that first degree of separation, then you rule them out. Mm-hmm. But if it was more than that, again, they would have lawyered up. They would not have given continued access. But then you do a deeper dive on Tommaso. Tommaso is a sixth grade charter school teacher in biology and science. Mm-hmm. He has got no criminal record, no background. There is zero arc of this type of unhealthy behavior. And if they're so hard up for money, there's a lot of easier ways like robbing a bank than there is of doing this. So yeah. It just does not. Yeah. He and the family, the immediate family, Nancy's family does not fit. Again, I am always open to outliers.
Yeah.
And this could be an outlier because we don't have all the data. We don't have everything. I'm just telling you from what we're observing from the outside, this is what explains behavior law enforcement, focusing in on that household as the primary caregivers, as the ones that set up contracts and people have access to Nancy, that I would be treasure troving, get all those data points in there. And if someone inside that house was fearful of them being discovered as the real perpetrator of this, they wouldn't have given access anymore, at least without search warrants or anything else. But there's been the appearance of, could be different behind the scenes, but appearance of complete cooperation. And it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, you got to kind of view Annie's house and her husband's as almost an extension of Nancy's.
Yeah.
And the easiest way to do that is anybody out there who has elderly parents or anybody that cares, that's the caregiver for somebody that doesn't live in your home. Your records, all of that, just think about it for a second. How much of that is, you know, literally their information that had they been a little bit younger in life, that would have all been in their house. They would have been taking care of it, but they don't anymore. And they have a caregiver that's doing it. So that's pretty freaking normal. That's nothing odd. I think everybody is very quick to go, police are at X location. They must be getting bad guy. That's not how this works.
Nancy's house is ground zero for information.
Yes.
Yes.
And to the quote that just came across from our listener, it's fantastic. If you are trying to get money from your 84-year-old mom, just wait a couple years. I mean, it just makes no sense whatsoever.
None of it makes a lot of sense. This doesn't, I mean, and look, I don't know the finances of the family. Obviously, Savannah makes money, but that doesn't mean Savannah's just passing out checks, you know, to people either. But again, like you said, if someone is in some sort of a financial strait, and we've seen that in other cases, this would be the path of most resistance to get that money. This is not exactly like the quickest way or the most efficient way of obtaining money for whatever you needed. Abducting your mother-in-law this doesn't make sense. It's not a logical path. And yes, could there be outliers? Of course there could be. But if we're looking at the laws of averages here, what makes sense? Let's just follow the path of least resistance in Occam's razor. And look, none of that seems to add up. It makes for like the horrible, this, if you're going to put this into a movie script, sure. But is it that? No, like you said, the family is not lawyered up. They've been cooperating extensively in every possible way they can. Yep. You know, could someone have been looked at as a suspect for a moment in time? Of course. Sure. Does it mean it went anywhere? No. But that could be just how that's how you flush out an investigation. Yep. There's so many questions.
I'm sorry. So think about this. So you're the investigator, you're the interviewers, and you're going to the mom's house first, and you're getting some data points in, and you're investigating there, and there's not a lot there because it's she's an elderly woman, it's an empty house, probably got some photos, got some nice things. But then as time's progressing a little bit, and you find out Annie's the main person, and the shock of what's going on wore off a little bit, and Annie's and her husband are thinking to themselves, well, we did this, and the investigators, you did what? You set up what?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, we handled everything in her life. Oh, we got to refocus over here now.
Yeah.
It's always about what makes sense. It's always the path of least. It's generally what makes sense is what is going to really what happens in the end. When you try to make things too complicated by these big nefarious things, I've never seen it work out that way. It just doesn't because. Yeah. If it was, it's an outlier. What happens in outliers, there's more people involved, more leakage. And the messaging they're using was really good, you know, in the messages, the family messages they put out. You would have flushed out at this point if there's a probability of someone else involved with some sort of empathy that could give information. I mean, because you knew if there was a cabal of two or three people that had Nancy abducted, there'd be infighting like this. Well, you'd have one person, give me the money, or give me communicate. We need to make sure. I mean, you'd be having infighting, and then someone would break and leak or do something, and we're not seeing any of it.
Let me
and
ask
that's how you, that works, right? I mean, yes. This is, yeah, okay.
Let me ask you this, because this is another interesting thing that's been taking place over the last several days. The helicopter that's been, several have seen it circling over the area, and I saw the flight path of it the other day. You're an aviation guy. Did you see the flight path of this helicopter, the circling, the gazillion circling over, I don't know how many times, but it was a lot, kind of over the property. Over and over and over and over. I don't know how many times it was, but it was a lot of circling. I'm as you being an aviator, you know a hell of a lot more about that world than I do. I'm just going to throw it out there. I'm not even going to give you my conjecture. What's your conjecture? Why? Why were they doing that? What do you think they were possibly trying to glean by circling the helicopter over the property for the crazy amount of times that they were?
You know, I'm a little befuddled, not super befuddled by it. So the aviation assets have a lot of interesting equipment on board that they can do a lot of things with. And obviously they're using that interesting equipment in doing this. I think they're really trying to identify surveillance locations that were used outside the house. They're looking for disturbed ground. They're looking for tips and leads around that property, as well as maybe terrain mapping it, I really think they're looking for disturbed soil kinds of stuff.
Yeah. My other thought, and I'm going to give you this conjecture on it, because we've already talked in this case about Bluetooth connections here, one being Nancy's heart.
I looked at
pacemaker. And her pacemaker and her phone or her watch, her Apple Watch. I am wondering, are they getting a signal from somewhere near that property that somehow points back to Nancy?
I looked at this.
Yeah, okay. Give me your thoughts.
So when you're dealing with new situations, it forces you to innovate in ways that you couldn't, that you never thought of before. And so, and I'm sure a lot of people have looked at this too. So pacemakers cannot be used as GPS devices, but they do give off signals and do automatically connect to a device if they're within 100 feet. I think it's around the max range of that. And so it's going to really depend. So, because I was really looking at, is there a way that they could actually roam that property and use something to actually trigger a download if that pacemaker, well, it won't get gruesome, but if that pacemaker is anywhere around on that property in any way. The jury's out on it. It would do a download to like her watch or her synced device, because here's the bottom line. The pacemaker does not stop working if the patient stops working.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so there is a possibility of being able to, I think, with a lot of good science at it, might be able to do something with that, maybe. But it'd have to be really, really close proximity. I don't think a helicopter overhead would be able to do anything with that.
It makes me, I mean, it's not like it's not like Nancy is a cell tower, you know?
No, like, she's not going to ping.
Like you're kind of landing and you're like, it's supposed to be an airplane mode, but I got a signal, you know?
Right. Very, very low energy ping, not even a ping. It's a low energy download that happens when you're in a close proximity, because remember, they don't open up the heart every couple months to replace the batteries.
It's a Bluetooth connection. I mean, it's like, it's you walk across your house and your music stops playing. Oh, I'm too far away from the Bluetooth.
Right.
It's the same principle.
Yep.
Your thoughts, everybody, thus far on the conversation, give it to us on our Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. You can join us there. It's free to join right now. There's no fee. Everything is accessible, and you get all of our reporting a day in advance. I'd love to get your thoughts there. Also on YouTube, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Find us there and weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.